All right, we'll call the Health and Human Service Reform Committee to order this morning. And first up on the agenda, we have, we do have a quorum, by the way. We'll bring up first House File 809. And Representative Franzen moves that House File 809 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. With her today is Representative Hugh, who has a clone bill to this bill as well. Welcome to the committee. If you please present your testimony.
Thank you, and good morning, members. Happy Thursday, by the way. The purpose of this bill is very simple. It would simply stop the use of tax dollars from paying for abortion. It would do this by having Minnesota follow the same policy as the federal government, which has prohibited taxpayer-funded abortions for decades, with the exceptions of abortions done to save the life of a woman and in the cases of rape or incest. Only one program would be affected by this legislation, and that's the state's Medicaid program. The federal government already prohibits taxpayer funding of abortions for women on Medicaid. Additionally, Minnesota's other programs already prohibit taxpayer-funded abortions, except in the case of saving the life of the mother in the cases of rape or incest. And this legislation would apply the same restrictions to those on medical assistance. I believe that women deserve better than abortion. Providing free abortions does nothing to help women. It leaves them exactly in the same place, but without one of their children. I think the state is better off providing real help and support to pregnant women, and that's why when the department came to me to offer the expanded Target at-home visiting services, I agreed to do so. I find that that is one piece of legislation that we can support to help pregnant women in need. And so at this time, I'll let Cindy say a few words, and then Ms. Andrea Rao from MCCL will come up to further testimony.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Pugh. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. State Representative Cindy Pugh, House District 33B. I represent Shane Hassan and 9 of the 16 communities surrounding Lake Minnetonka. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And although I don't have any prepared remarks, I do have a number of points I would like to make. And maybe most importantly, that I am the author of House File 810, which, Mr. Chairman, as you already stated, is your own bill. For those in the listening public today, I think that that probably isn't understood. So I just wanted to make a point about what that is. Every House file has 35 spaces on it for signatures of members. And once those spaces are full, oftentimes there is an opportunity to introduce a second bill. So that's what this one is. And I don't know how many clone bills there are in the Minnesota legislature in the House, but I noticed just yesterday that almost 2,000 bills have been introduced, and I don't think that there are that many clone bills. So I think that puts an exclamation point on really how significant this particular bill is and the great interest that there is amongst the legislators. I know that there are increased pro-life majorities in both the House and Senate, and I think that this bill, although it's very similar, if not exact, to one that we've brought before, is very reflective of the will of the people, certainly in my district, but I believe throughout the state of Minnesota. Especially, and I think the last point that I would want to make, and the reason that I very much wanted to at least be an author on this bill, is that I represent one of the highest tax districts in the state. And good people can agree to disagree, but one thing that I have heard from a majority of my constituents is that they want and expect representation reflective of their will, and they do not want their tax dollars used to pay for abortion. So I thank you for the opportunity to present.
All right. Thank you, Representative Pugh. And Representative Franzen, you said you had a testifier. If she could make her way down. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. We are Minnesota's oldest and largest pro-life organization, and I would really like to thank the committee for allowing me to provide testimony this morning. I am here today to urge you to pass House File 809. House File 809 would conform Minnesota's policy on taxpayer-funded abortion with the federal government by reinstating a ban on the practice of providing free abortions to women on the state's Medicaid program, medical assistance. In 1978, Minnesota passed a law that prohibited taxpayer-funded abortions, except to save the life of the mother, and where the pregnancy is the result of rape or incest, just like the federal government's Hyde Amendment. However, a lower court ruling in June of 1994 struck down that ban, and the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe v. Gomez decision established the so-called right to abortion in the Minnesota Constitution, just as Roe v. Wade did on the federal level. However, the Gomez decision goes even further by requiring that Minnesota taxpayers be forced to pay for abortions, one of the nation's most extreme state policies regarding abortion, an opposite of federal requirements. As a result, approximately 40% of all abortions performed in Minnesota are now paid for with tax dollars. From the time of the court decisions until 2014, taxpayers spent more than $22 million on more than 73,000 abortions. Even more concerning to me than these numbers is that while the number of abortions in Minnesota has dropped substantially, the percentage of taxpayer-funded abortions has been increasing. This means that the children of poor women are being aborted at a much higher rate than among families who are more financially stable. We know from women that when they feel supported, they are much more likely to choose life for their children. But we cannot deny that a huge disparity exists in Minnesota. When a woman finds herself pregnant, if she is on MA, she is much more likely to abort her child than if she is not. And as I said, approximately 40% of all abortions are paid for by MA, while only about 20% of Minnesotans are covered by the program. After researching and talking with insurance insiders, it is our understanding that many, if not most, insurance plans sold on the individual market in Minnesota do not cover abortion services, except with the same exceptions that would be covered under this bill, namely to save the life of the mother and in cases where the pregnancy is due to rape or incest. Thus, this legislation is not seeking to and does not discriminate against poor women, as is frequently cited by opponents of the bill. Rather, the bill puts women of less financial means on the same footing as others. It removes a perceived incentive to abort their children. The reality is that our current system of using taxpayer funds to abort the children of poor women leads to the false notion that having an abortion will somehow make their lives better. Our state would be well served by removing the false assertion that the lives of poor women are better because they have free abortion coverage. The issue being examined by the committee today is not whether abortion should be legal or illegal, as this bill does not outlaw the procedure. It does, however, return the issue of whether or not the taxpayers of this state should be forced to fund a practice which the majority oppose to the policymakers of this state, where the decision is rightly decided. Polling has consistently shown that most people do not support taxpayer-funded abortion. For example, a 2015 poll found that 68% of Americans oppose taxpayer funding of abortion. This includes 69% of women and 71% of millennials. Unless we wish to force Minnesota citizens to continue to fund an act which they do not support and which doesn't further the public good, and to do so at a rate of more than 10 times every day, weekends included, we should all be supporting this common sense legislation that protects and respects our fellow citizens. On behalf of MCCL and our grassroots supporters across this great state, I urge you to support House File 809. Thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rao. And members, we'll hold off on questions until we've gone through all the testimony today, and then we'll move into the question and comment period. Representative Franzen, do you have any other testifiers on your behalf?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair.
All right. Then we'll open it up to public testimony. We have on the agenda Ms. Andrea Ledger. If you could please make your way to the testifying table, state your name, welcome to the committee, and say your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the Executive Director of New Law Pro Choice Minnesota. We represent 60,000 members, and our mission is to provide support for personal decision making in the full range of reproductive health options. I'm here in opposition to this bill. In 1995, as you heard from Ms. Rao, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in Doe versus Gomez that, quote, the difficult decision whether to obtain a therapeutic abortion will not be made by the government, but will be left to the woman and her doctor. The court further held that so long as Minnesota funded pregnancy care, it could not refuse to fund care related to abortion. A challenge to Gomez was dismissed by a Minnesota district court judge in 2013. In her decision, she stated that, quote, we trust doctors to provide accurate information about why they're providing medical treatment to women. This constitutional-level decision can only be undone by the court reversing itself or through a constitutional amendment. As a policy matter, this bill is discriminatory and would likely not succeed in its aims of reducing abortion. A woman's health insurance should enable her to take care of her health and well-being. When a woman needs to end her pregnancy, by providing health coverage for abortion, we're helping ensure that she will be able to see a licensed, quality health provider and get the care that she needs. In the real world, restrictions on abortion access don't eliminate abortion, but they can push women to make the decision later in pregnancy or push abortion out of reach altogether. Low-income women often have difficulty raising the money to pay for abortion care, and research indicates that economic barriers often cause them to obtain abortion care 2 to 3 weeks later in pregnancy than wealthier women. When a woman is living paycheck to paycheck, denying coverage for an abortion can push her deeper into poverty. Indeed, studies show that a woman who seeks an abortion but is denied is 3 times more likely to fall into poverty than one who is able to get an abortion. Finally, when it comes to the most important decisions in life, such as whether to become a parent, it is vital that a woman be able to consider all her options, including an abortion, no matter what her income or source of insurance. A woman facing an unintended pregnancy should not have to make her health decisions based on whether she has enough money. It should be based on what is best for her health and her family circumstances. If abortion coverage is available to some, it should be available to all. We shouldn't treat some women's health needs differently than others just because of the type of insurance they have. When Governor Dayton vetoed a similar bill in 2011, he said that he would not sign a bill that infringes upon a woman's constitutionally protected rights. I urge you to vote no on House File 809.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Ledger, for your testimony this morning. Next, we have Dr. Creedon. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Creedon. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Douglas Creedon. I'm an OBGYN physician, and I'm currently the chair of the Minnesota section of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And I'm here today to state my opposition to this bill as it's been submitted. My concerns as an OBGYN provider, and first of all, I want to state from the outset, I don't think anybody in this room wants to promote abortions. I don't think the goal here is for people to have more abortions. As an OBGYN provider, I don't want that. That's not the ACOG's goal, is to promote abortions. It's a very difficult decision for a woman to make. And I think it's important that a woman be allowed to make that regardless of her income level or regardless of other people's thoughts on this intensely private and personal issue and matter. I've submitted a letter to the committee that states my concerns about the imbalance in this bill of restricting the funds that could be available to particularly low-income women. And we know that a majority of abortions occur in low-income women, so this is going to significantly affect those women. Abortions will happen regardless of what restrictions we place on them. I mean, history tells us this. So if we're going to proceed, in my mind, the most important thing we can do is not legislation that will restrict abortions, but legislation that will help women prevent unplanned and unintended pregnancies. And I strongly encourage the committee to consider legislations that will prevent the need for abortion in the first place. If we're going to spend state dollars, then I would hope that it be spent wisely, and that would meet the needs of every member in this committee, whether those who are either for abortions or against them. Again, I don't think anyone wants to promote more abortions. You have my letter as written, and then I thank you for the opportunity to testify here.
Thank you, Dr. Creedon, for your testimony this morning. That's all we had for the folks that I knew about who wanted to testify. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 809? Seeing no one, we'll close public testimony and move to member questions and comments. Are there any questions or comments from members? Representative Wiebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question. I don't know which of the testifiers could answer it, but Ms. Rao was talking about the number of abortions that are performed or the percentage that are performed on MA, and I was wondering if anyone has the information about how many deliveries or what proportion of deliveries are actually funded by medical assistance.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lublin, I do not have that information.
Representative Wiebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to be reminded of what that is, but I suspect it's quite high, and I know that nationwide it's gotten quite high. So, you know, we've rehashed this issue very often. We've heard this bill numerous times, and, you know, it's really no different now than it's been in the past. I think a lot of the testimony from Ms. Rao, and this is not a question, just a statement, but a lot of the testimony from Ms. Rao is about, you know, really boils down to the fact that, you know, we know that a lot of times women feel really desperate when they become pregnant, and they know that having another child will completely upset the economics underpinnings of their life. And so, you know, to talk about as though somehow having available medical assistance is encouraging abortion, I think is to kind of turn the situation on its head, where the real situation is that poor women often feel desperate that they simply cannot handle another pregnancy. So I just kind of wanted to put that out there, and I think other members may want to comment as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lublin. Representative Murphy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Representative Franson, and Pugh, and Ms. Rao. It's good to see you. Hate the bill. You know that. For all sorts of reasons. And I'm trying to bring my best self to this debate. There was a comment made that, first, that this legislation is strong because so many members have signed on to it, and that there's a clone bill I would like to say that's also true for the Minnesota Care Buy-In proposal that we would love to have heard here. And if the fact that there's a clone bill and lots of members that support an idea is the reason we should hear and move something, then I would say let's schedule that bill as well, because it's a good one. It would cover this. It would cover abortion. And I'm also, you know, well, not happy to be here today, happy that the issue of politics was lifted up, because this is certainly, above all things, a political issue. And we're hearing this today for political purposes. It won't become law. We know that. And I have no doubt that there are people in this room, people who are elected, who have very strong and earnest feelings about this, that Ms. Rao and the work that you do is in pursuit of something you believe deeply. And I don't doubt that. And I think you see in me the pursuit of the work that I'm doing about preventing unintended pregnancies with the same zeal for the same purpose. But there was a statement made that we should pass this because people's lives will be better and because there are insurance policies being sold that don't include abortion care and that poor women should have access to that same policy, that we're not weakening insurance coverage, but instead we would be somehow strengthening insurance coverage. And I just disagree with that, but I understand the political nature of that statement. In this legislature, since we've been elected, we have seen now a couple of different efforts to limit benefits, not just this benefit, not just this coverage, but coverage for things like maternity care and insurance policies in the individual market. We've seen that issue raised up in bill form and in amendment form, where there's an effort to limit access to basic care. I consider this basic care. And we're seeing not only an effort, an attack on women's health care here by saying, if you're poor, we don't want you to have access to an abortion. We want you to have that baby. But we're also seeing the same effort, that same group of people saying, let's also not cover maternity care. And so it makes me wonder, since we're talking about politics, what the posture of the Republican Party really is when it comes to women's health. We don't want you to have an abortion, but we also don't want to cover your maternity care if you're pregnant. And we also don't want to cover access to child care if you have that child for low-income women. I have to wonder what the posture of the party is, what the posture of the majority is with regard to women and children. When we sew together the different proposals that we're seeing coming from this body. So I wasn't going to bring up the issue of politics or partisan politics, except for that it was raised in the testimony. This is a proposal that will hurt women. It will limit their choices. If we believe that women are fully autonomous individuals capable of making their own decisions, then there is no way you can support this piece of legislation, because we are indeed saying to them that you cannot make that decision for yourself. But I also would ask everybody to check their guts a little bit about what we stand for with regard to women. If we're not willing to afford or cover maternity care, and we're not willing to cover child care and basic child care and affordable child care, what are we saying about this legislature and its posture for women and families? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify to Representative Murphy, I signed on to the bill not for political purposes whatsoever. I signed on because I am a pro-life and believe in the life of a child and the beauty of a expected mother. I do have earnest feelings on this, and I am for covering maternity care and for child care. Many of my colleagues that I know are too. So I think it just has to be on the record for those who will listen to this today and perhaps in the future, that the Republican Party is for life, for maternity care, for child care, and for care of all those who need care. So to say that we don't care and are not in favor of maternity care or for child care is completely false. It's not in my party, and not the folks that I know that I've been working with for 7 years down here and for 20-some years back in Wright County. So I reject that statement. I think it's painted with a broad brush. I think it's unfair, and it's usually not something that you usually do, at least that I've discovered in 7 years. So political purposes, I don't see it. I see it as a life purpose. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that anyone that signed on to the bill is thinking this is going to be good for political purposes. That's baloney. It's good for life. That's how we feel. It's a life and death issue. You know the issue better than anyone, or just as well as anyone. Political purposes. Let's not play that game. It's about life.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a couple of comments. I want to thank Representative Franson and Representative Pugh for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a critical issue for our state. You know, when abortion was legalized back in 1973, we didn't have the medical science that we have today. And medical science has advanced since 1973, especially in the area of conception. And we now know that life begins at conception. That is simply a medical and scientific fact. Now, in recognition of that, we see different countries around the world, especially in Europe and even Russia, moving to limit abortion based on medical science. It's America that continues to refuse to recognize that medical science and adjust their laws accordingly. You can check on the internet, but Russia only allows abortion up to the 12th week of pregnancy, and I think beyond that, for certain exceptions, one is the life of the mother. So I think it's time that we realize the rest of the world is moving in a direction based on medical science, and we still are living in the uninformed and unscientific past on this issue. Second thing is, I've known parents who wanted to adopt children. There's a severe shortage of children available to adopt in this country, it seems, based on the input I've received. In fact, the surrogacy movement claims that the children aren't available, and therefore we have to somehow legalize surrogacy in our state and nation, which I strongly disagree with. The other thing I'd just say, even there's an economic consequence also to killing your own children. Most of the world recognize that. China recently has moved from a one-child policy to a two-child policy. They realize that when a nation supports killing its own children, that's bad economics. And we know what's happening here in this state as far as the demographic changes and the killing of 60 million unborn children. I especially want to speak to the ladies. Ladies, we don't want to see this happen to you. And we prefer some alternative courses to save the life of the baby, which we now know begins at conception. And I believe it would be better for not only the woman, but also the unborn child especially. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Weebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to respond to a couple of points that members have made. You know, it's hard to resist. You know, I know we've had this debate a lot, but I think some points have been made that really require a response. First of all, to Representative McDonald, you know, I know that a lot of members really do care. I don't doubt anybody's sincerity on this issue. I really don't. Although, you know, in this place, it's really hard to separate the politics of something from a personal conviction. I get that. However, I just wanted to note that if Republicans really care about maternity, about child care, you know, we had a child care subsidy waiting list in this state for many, many years. And what would it take to get rid of it? Money. Right? Well, this year we have, what, a $1.6 billion surplus? And this legislature, Republicans in charge in the House and Senate, are going to be making important decisions about how that gets allocated. So, I love the fact that on this committee, we've heard from a lot of members, and on the HHS Finance Committee as well, a lot of members on the Republican side have carried bills that are wonderful bills, that are all about caring for people, that are about making people get what they need to be productive citizens, the things that help children grow up strong and have, overcome disadvantages from poverty and so on. But push comes to shove when we see what gets funded. And when this has been raised in some committees and some debates, we've heard, oh, you're politicizing it. Well, to the Republican members, your commitment will be seen loud and clear when the budgets come out. And if you're cutting taxes for wealthy people and there's still a waiting list for child care and there's still underfunding of contraception and there's still underfunding for, you know, if the Republicans in Congress cut Medicaid funding, we will see, because budgets are really about values. And, you know, it's great for members to say, I'm for this and I'm for that, and I don't doubt that you are. But priorities are what really count. And when we see the budget and when we see how much goes to tax cuts as opposed to how much goes to meeting the needs of poor people, of poor kids in this state, of whom there are many, there are many desperately poor kids in this state. You know, the amount of cash people get for so-called welfare, our Minnesota Family Investment Program, that still hasn't been raised since 1986. And this year there's a bill from a Republican member to raise it $100 a month. I sure hope that gets funded. Every pro-life member should be leaning on leadership to fund that, because that's what we're talking about. If your priority is really the children, then don't agree to give tax cuts to wealthy people in this state until those needs are really funded. So that's what I wanted to say on that point. To Representative Grunhagen's point about science proving that life begins at conception, you know, this has never been about science. This is about how each individual family, each individual woman balances her priorities. It's not about what, it's never been a debate about what, you know, there's never been a debate that a fertilized embryo can grow into a baby. That's never been the issue. And whether people call that life and whether they think it's already a child or an embryo or a fetus, is the bottom line is that each individual woman should get to decide that. It's a matter of values. It's a matter of priorities. Some of us would never make that decision personally to have an abortion, or we think we wouldn't. But until you walk in a woman's shoes, you don't really know. This is about what individual women decide to do in their own lives, Representative Grunhagen, and saying, calling us ladies and telling us that you're going to somehow protect us really doesn't fly very well, because we women are adults, and, you know, women who are making this decision, by and large, are adults. I get there are a few who are very, very young who shouldn't be bearing a child, I would say. But these are very difficult decisions. When life begins is a decision that the individual woman has to be allowed to make. Now, finally, I just want to say something about the reference to China. My goodness, China. In China, they told families they couldn't have more children. That is not what this is about. This is about government getting out of women's way and letting them make the decision. Now, I get that some Minnesotans don't like it that we're providing state funds to do that, and I think other members will want to speak to that, but I just can't be silent when I hear a comparison to China, where people were forced to have abortions. Nobody would tolerate forcing women to have abortions. That is just absolutely antithetical to what we're talking about, which is women being autonomous beings who get to make the decision. And as Dr. Creedon said, for goodness sakes, let's make it so that fewer and fewer women have to be in that difficult position. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just getting back to the bill, and we heard testimony from Ms. Rao and from other testifiers too around just like legal implications with this, right? So if this were to pass, what do you think it would cost the state to defend this?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, members of the committee, I don't know what the cost would be. I think that varies greatly. The legislature, though, I think has a duty to pass legislation that they believe in, and then turn it over to the courts if that's what ends up happening. The legislature also has a policy that they don't include funding for potential court costs. That's a longstanding policy of the legislature.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you think that that's a good way to spend state money defending something like this?
Ms. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, members of the committee, I think that this is a just law if this were to pass, and I think that that would be a good use of taxpayer funds to support that. The federal government has brought this case forward. This has come through the federal courts many times and has been upheld. We think the same should be true in Minnesota.
Representative Olson? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in kind of a unique position here. I'm the one male member of the DFL side of the House and Human Services Reform Committee here. The House DFL caucus as a whole is actually almost exactly 50-50 male-female right now, which I think is awesome and a great sign of progress here. It puts me in a slightly unique position here. You know, I think the term mansplaining gets overused sometimes, but when I hear members say, let me tell something to the ladies here, let me tell you what's best for you, let me tell you what the best decision for you is here, it's hard to find a more textbook example of mansplaining than that, and it's I was fairly taken aback by that. And I think it's kind of indicative of this bill. I mean, we shouldn't allow politicians to make medical decisions for someone based on how she receives her health insurance. It's political interference in a woman and her family's private medical decisions. She shouldn't have to base her decision on whether or not to end a pregnancy on whether she has enough money. It should be based on what's best for her and her family in consultation with her health care provider. And then, as has been noted by Representative Olson, this bill would violate Minnesota's constitutionally guaranteed right to privacy, which does include reproductive decision-making. You know, we shouldn't be here telling the ladies what's best for them. We should be voting no on this bill.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I could introduce a third gender, but that's a whole different issue. Maybe we or they. But in our current existing constitutional framework and under current law, it's about choice. And both sides talk about choice. And you, pro-life talks about choice as well. I mean, they're from the churches, and it's about helping women make choices, and so you acknowledge that. But this bill, my question is that under current law, women do have a choice, and so how do you deny, create a two-tier system where those that are poor cannot have access to abortion, who basically you're taking choice away, trying to. That's not possible, but at this point, but about access and the ability to pay, and the fact that you're setting up a two-tiered system. So how do you justify that under how we operate here, that we are not trying to discriminate or burden the poor, those that are unable to afford. So can you talk about that equality issue?
Ms. Ralph.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, members of the committee. First of all, you talked about not being able to have an abortion, and that's a burden. I think the outcome here is a child, and I don't consider a child a burden. So that's point number one. Further, just because I'll grant you that under our current rulings in the court, they see a right to abortion. That's a right to a woman to make that decision according to the Constitution right now. But that doesn't guarantee in all cases, just because you have a right to something, to make some choice, doesn't mean that you have a right to have the government pay for it. And that is exactly what the federal government has ruled. And so we would agree with that. This is not limiting her choices. This is not discriminating. MA also doesn't cover you know, everything under the sun. There are a number of different procedures and different things that are not covered under MA. We don't think that this is a procedure that should be covered under MA.
Representative Allen.
But this is a bill about money, about cost. It's not a bill about the utility of abortion or, but the cost, denying somebody the current rights and privileges of citizenship. That if only women with means can pay, have the ability to pay, and so that they can exercise their rights, and as a citizen, we're denying people the right to participate, the right to be, to have the same rights as others, based on the ability to pay. So, I mean, the economic, the bill here is not about, it's not policy, it's an actual economic and appropriations, it's about money.
Ms. Brown, did you have a follow-up to that?
I could talk, members of the committee, Mr. Chair, you know, for a long time, but I'm not sure that there was a question, so I'll refrain.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I walk the shoes. Been in that position. Know what it's like. I know that when you find out that you're pregnant and you don't want to be, when it's unintended, your thought is about you. I didn't think much about the fact that I was pregnant with a baby. I didn't think about that hardly at all. I thought about me. Now my husband, Greg, and I went to a pregnancy crisis center, and there we found out options. And I'm talking about all options. We talked about abortion. I'm not proud to say that, but we did, because my thoughts were all based on me, what I was feeling, what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I didn't want to do this. It was a really hard decision all the way around, but we chose to carry the baby and to do an adoption plan. What I think happens a lot is when the choices are made that early, it is all about me. What I don't hear a lot about is that when you choose, when you think, oh, abortion is the only thing I want to do, I don't think you hear a lot of the options that are out there for everyone. Adoption is a big part of how a lot of families get babies, and we're not seeing that happen anymore, to the point where now we're looking into other options, paying for women to have babies. To me, that is so sad. It is so sad that we've gone that way. You know, we can talk about that there isn't the money to do it, but I know that the ACA doesn't cover abortions. When I came here in 13 and 14, there was only one party in control of all three branches. I guess we can all look back on what we did and didn't do in 2013, 2014, when we talk about funding for everything. But right now, today, we're talking about taxpayer money going to fund abortions. So if we want to talk about how much a court case is going to cost, we can talk about how much the state of Minnesota has spent in taxpayer dollars to help with this. And what I do look at is, you know, when I got pregnant, it was my responsibility. I didn't look to anybody to help me out. I was 17, a minor, so yes, insurance covered it. But there was still money to be paid, and we paid it. We did it. It was my issue. I didn't look to anybody else to take care of it. So when I look at this as, you know, it's only a taxpayer way to do this that so many happen, it's really scary to me that maybe there's a lot of women who could have had more choices in front of them. And yes, I am pro-choice in that let's look at all the choices all the time. Let's not just look at a few of them. And yes, I was president of Birthline, which I absolutely love because their mission is to support life, not only a baby's life, but also a mother and a father's life, too. Because when you say fathers aren't involved, baloney. My husband was totally involved with it all the way around. And some dads don't know. So, yeah, you can say it isn't, but it was a decision we made together. So I don't buy that it's just a woman's decision. It was his, too. He was there. And it was my choice to be active. It was my choice. I did it. And I knew, you know, we knew about prevention and had ways to do it, and it didn't work. So when we want to say, you know, oh, this, that, and another thing, it is about the money. It is about taxpayer funding. I think that Minnesota taxpayers should have the option of whether or not they want the dollars to go there. I really don't think that this is a political issue. I think it is a personal issue. I think it is health care for women. I don't want to see a woman go through something and regret it. And it does happen, because even Brookline, some of the folks do training in how to do post-abortion care, because there's a lot of women who do feel the loss, the regret. And unfortunately, they don't have a lot of places to go to find that, or they don't know that there's options out there. So if we're truly going to talk about options, I think we need to put all options out there, because there's a lot of them. And you know what? Yeah, it was my choice. But also make sure that everybody knows that it was my choice. It was my choice to be sexually active, and it was my choice to not do it. But I will say that if I would have made a decision in the first month or two when I found out, I probably wouldn't have carried my son to term. But now I have three sons. And Rob now has two children. And I think about, if I would have just done it right away without really looking into all the options, that family wouldn't be here today. And I don't know if I could live with that. It's tough to live sometimes about, you know, going through the pregnancy and placing a child for adoption, because a lot of people say, oh, I couldn't do that. But you can. You can do it. And when I look at my family now, I think, you know what, I want that for everybody. I want for everybody to look back on their life and say, wow, I didn't know that was available. I want them to say, yay, you know, we had all the options in front of us. And that's what I want. I want women to step away from these decisions to say, I can live with this. I don't want them to have to go through a life of regret and despair. And as far as taxpayer money going towards it, I just don't think that's the right thing to do. It's not because I don't want a woman to get health care necessarily. I want them to have all the options, but I also want them to know that it was your choice. It was my choice. I take full responsibility for it. But I also want other women to really feel like this was a decision they made, looking at all choices. Thank you.
Representative Fagel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, unintended pregnancies remains a significant global health problem, and 41% of all pregnancies worldwide in 2008 were unintended. And unintended pregnancies rates are greater in less developed regions than in more developed regions, with the United States being the notable exception. Among U.S. women, nearly half of unintended pregnancies are due to incorrect or inconsistent contraception methods. So long-acting reversible contraception is extremely safe and over 99% effective at preventing pregnancies. And despite their level of effectiveness, less than 15% of contraception women worldwide use long-acting reversible contraception. Education, access, and cost are the primary barriers. This has been studied in the U.S. Nearly 10,000 women ages 14 to 45, when those three barriers were removed, 75% of study participants chose to use long-acting reversible contraception. As a result, a reported 80% reduction in teen births and 75% reduction in abortions among women in the cohort compared to national statistics. So if we're really serious about reducing unintended pregnancies, we need to be serious about increasing the use of methods that we know work. So my question is, are you willing to work on solutions like access to long-acting reversible contraceptions, like what's proposed in the governor's budget in House File 795?
Representative Branson?
Was she asking me a question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, House File 795 does not have anything to do with this bill. Right now we are discussing House File 809.
Representative Cagle?
Well, I guess my question is, if we're really serious about reducing abortions, are we willing to look at methods that work and that will prevent them from the onset?
Representative Branson?
Like I said, we are not discussing that topic today. We're discussing House File 809.
Representative Flanagan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is hard. There are some old pros who've been part of this debate here for a long time. And we'll talk later. Sorry about that. That's an amazing. And this is the first time that myself and some of my colleagues have been at this table to have this conversation. And it's hard because there are people on the other side who I care about and I respect, and we partner and work together on other issues and initiatives. And so this is just difficult, and I just want to name that. I also think we all bring our own lens and experience to this issue. You know, for myself, I am the mom of a four-year-old amazing kiddo. And when I was pregnant with her, I was very, very ill. I had hyperemesis gravidarum, which essentially just means severe morning sickness, and had it for the first 28 weeks of my pregnancy. And what that meant was that I was hospitalized over 7 times. I would oftentimes just have to lay in bed in the dark just to make it. And there was one instance where I came home, or my husband came home, and found me laying on the bathroom floor. And I was so weak and so dehydrated that he had to rush me to the emergency room. And I was on the floor in the bathroom, and whatever tears I had left, I started just crying and thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know that I can make it through this entire pregnancy feeling this bad. And it was in that moment that I realized for myself that I didn't want to have to make that decision for anybody else, because it was a deeply, deeply personal decision. And I was fortunate that after 28 weeks, I felt better. And shortly thereafter, I had preeclampsia and was on bed rest for 5 weeks. But I share that personal story with you because we all have personal stories related to this issue. And I hope that it allows us to see the humanity in one another as we're making these decisions. I also have someone who grew up in a low-income family and who used Medicaid. And what's hard for me when we are here and we sit at this table is how often we make decisions without low-income people. And how often we make decisions about people we are not in relationship with. And this, to me, appears to be, again, one of those times. And so I guess my question is, how many women on Medicaid have you talked to in putting this legislation together? And I guess this would be to Ms. Rao.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee, this is legislation that actually has been around for, frankly, decades at this point. But I can tell you that I do know women that are on Medicaid as well. Like you said, we all have personal stories. We all have personal relationships. And this is not put together in the dark. without considering them.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have they been part of the conversation in putting this legislation together?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I said initially, this legislation existed before my time at MCCL, so I can't answer that.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to just lift up again this sort of two-tier system. We make it really difficult for folks in poverty to make it. And when I think about this bill in particular, an abortion would cost a woman on Medicaid nearly a third of her monthly family income. And so this is taking away an opportunity and a decision, I think, for women who are also trying to think about supporting their family as it currently exists. So I just wanted to sort of just lift that up. It's hard enough to be low income. And when we set up this two-tiered system and create a paternalistic system where we are valuing the perspective and choice of low-income women less, that to me is insulting and it's dangerous. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Flanagan. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the conversation of low-income, people that struggle, there are answers. In my district alone, there are 2 pregnancy centers. When you come to that pregnancy center and you ask for help, maybe even to decide, I'm thinking about having an abortion, what are my options, what am I going to do, there are counselors, qualified, licensed counselors, nurses, and doctors that are available to have those conversations. Not only are they offered that, but they are also offered funds to help them to get where they need to go, whether it's them alone or their family. They are offered diapers. They are offered clothing for their children. They are offered help with funding. The only thing that the pregnancy centers that I'm aware of require of them are that they buy their clothing, help whatever they need with time, and it's education time. So not only are we talking about, let's say, someone who's discovered they're pregnant and they're about 12 weeks pregnant, the opportunity to have a conversation about options, or maybe if they're looking for birth control, because that happens also, but also the opportunity to get support, to understand and be educated on how important it is to take care of yourself when you are pregnant and need advice about making sure you have vitamins, making sure you're healthy for that baby who is growing within you. Representative Flanagan, I was pregnant 6 times. I spent a lot of time throwing up, let me tell you. It was not fun. But that is a minor thing when I consider everything that happened in my family. I have 4 healthy children. And that support is so important. I was fortunate. I had a lot of maternal support from my own mother and actually my mother-in-law, the help that I needed. And support is what's important. And the pregnancy centers, I know, offer that support. And long after that baby's born, which is very important, whether they choose to keep the baby or to give it up for adoption, there are those guidances. There are those helps for those women. I've heard from many women that have gotten help, whether they've adopted the baby out or they have had, and actually a few that have had an abortion, and what has happened to them. And that center has offered them the direction that they have needed, the support. They're more successful. They help them to direct them to jobs. I happen to know there's one here in over in Little Canada that works very hard on helping people connect to jobs as well for their families. I happen to know actually a gentleman who seeks out jobs for the family, makes sure they get to work, drives them there, And there's a lot of good people out there that are helping families. So while we say the only way to help a family is to pay for an abortion, there are many other opportunities. Granted, not everyone sees or knows about them, and that's unfortunate. But I think that's where we need to go, and I really have seen a lot of success there. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Representative Flanagan. This is, like, really hard to have this discussion. And as I sit here, you know, we, as a group of people who believe in the Constitution, and I think, you know, why are we hearing this bill? This bill has violates the Minnesota Constitution. It's a violation, you know. And it's a clear state Supreme Court case law that, you know, that we are sitting here bringing a bill forth within this body that we know is a clear violation of the Minnesota Constitution. And so, you know, sex is a human act, right? That happens between a man and a woman, right? Whether you're poor, whether you are middle class, rich, whatever, it's an act that happens, right? And I wonder, you know, because we know it's such a natural act that people, you know, engage in, and often enough, there is a result could be unintended pregnancy. So before I go any further, I just wanted to ask Representative Franson, what does she think about contraceptions?
Representative Franson.
Well, I am not getting into my personal opinions on contraception. I am discussing House File 809.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Let me rephrase the question then. As a state legislator who create laws and policy, what do you think about creating a bill that is about contraception?
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran. So I'm discussing House File 809, not contraception.
Representative Franson, I'm discussing the same deal.
Okay. Well, Representative Moran, abortion is not contraception.
It is not. And it is not. But it could be. Some people will say it is.
Yeah.
You know? So I want to take us someplace here. But we need you to cooperate here because the deals go beyond just your viewpoint of what contraception is or may not be. So as I was listening to Representative Keel about the support that those two organizations have in her community, I think that's a beautiful thing, right? It's a good thing to have that type of support, right? And I believe, you know, that is definitely the same type of support like organizations like Planned Parenthood do. You know, they bring people in, they educate them, they talk about options, support, care, because that's important. Right? And it's not just about abortion. It's about how do you surround that woman with the necessary support that they need to make the best decision for themselves and their family. It is about care, right? And if a woman decides to go on to have that child, they also support them after that. So it is, you know, it is really is about the freedom to choose, the freedom to have options, the freedom to make decisions about yourself and your family. And so when we bring in, we're talking about freedom, and then we talk about Russia and China, which are countries with dictators that force women to have abortions, that, you know, I hope as we look at who we are as a state and a country, that we are the United States of America because we do care. We do care about people. We do care about the poor, our hope. And because we do care as a country who believes in that, who believe and recognize that there are poor people in this country, in this state, it is upon us to find ways that we can help and support them. And part of that is Medicaid. That's a part of who we are. But when we don't do that, when we look at poor people and say that's your problem because you're poor, the state don't need to stay out of your lives, or, you know, you need to make your own decision. We have conflicting messages for the poor. And so my hope is that, you know, when we look at women who are poor, who have engaged in a natural act, that, you know, if you believe abortion is wrong, you believe in life is the way to go, that we don't want to see unintended acts that happens, so why don't we invest in contraception? Why don't we be a little bit more proactive here and go to the front end, you know, and do a little bit more education and bring some bills into this body that we're going to invest in educating low-income women. And by the way, why don't we just bring a group of low-income women together and have a conversation with them about what they need? Why don't we stop doing things for them and do it with them and ask them what is best for them and what that looks like for them, with them? We do that way too often, not to engage the people that we're trying to think we're helping or defending without working with them. They have ideas. They have solutions. And they know what's best for themselves and their community and their family. We just need to take some time to engage them. So, I believe in the freedom to choose what's best for me and my family. In some ways, you know, in some ways, I believe that with all good intentions, there's always these, we come when we don't engage people in that process itself, we always come up with these unintended consequences. So, you know, I just end with, this bill violates the Minnesota Constitution. Period. Period. And I don't know why we are hearing it today in this committee, besides the I statements that I heard you open up with about your belief. So, it's hard. I'm a mother of 7. That was my choice. I made that choice. you know. But we are a country of freedom seekers. And giving people choices and options. And this is a choice that should be made by a woman and her family, her husband, them. They should be making that decision and not us. And I just end that there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of what I wanted to say has been said already, but when Representative Moran brought up the Constitution, I just I have to bring up life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In our Constitution, life is the number one thing that is mentioned, so I guess I'm just wanting to speak for the baby's right, because we are talking about a baby here. So, and I want to thank Representative Franzen and Representative Pugh and MCCL for bringing this bill forward. It was so distressing for me to hear 40% of abortions are paid for by tax dollars. And thank you for sharing that those statistics that 68% of the people in our state oppose taxpayer funding of abortions and oppose abortions, 69% of women, 79% of millennials. I just think that needs to be restated here. And I just thank you so much for bringing this forward. I hope we can support this today. And I just, too, I just want to bring up the whole point about low-income people, that we don't care about them. And I am 63 years old. My parents were very poor when I was growing up. We didn't have very much. But they weren't on medical assistance. It, just people weren't on that like they are today. And I'm the oldest of eight children, and I don't think that my parents felt like necessarily that they could afford each one of us. But I'm so thankful that they never made that choice. I don't think they necessarily even had that option, but I'm just love all of my siblings and glad that we're all here. And we struggled. Four sisters slept in the smallest little bedroom in our house. And I worked ever since I was about 10 years old babysitting and trying to just afford to have things that all my friends had. So, you know, this affordable thing, I mean, we make it work. It's about life and it's about loving and it's about, you know, life just can't be the perfect way that you want it to go all the time. But you make the best of things and you grow from your hard times. So I'm just really thankful that you brought this bill forward, and I hope that it passes today. Thank you very much.
Chair Dean. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And just to clear up a couple of technical issues, the question was brought up about how Minnesota defends itself in lawsuits. We do appropriate money to the Attorney General for that purpose. That we have a budget for that every year. We have no idea of when we're going to be sued for what kinds of stuff, but also so that is in place, and that is for all of us. We have no anticipation of, or can we predict the cost or the chances of any law being challenged, but that's how we handle that. That's how, whether it's a bill that's passed on one side of the aisle or the other, that's something that remains consistent. One of the things that I think is important with this discussion, and this bill deals with, we've covered a lot of ground, but this deals with how we pay for abortion services in Minnesota and whether or not the taxpayer funding should cover that, whether or not we're going to follow the federal law with a Hyde Amendment, and how we can be reasonably sure that we are following that law in the state of Minnesota with the way we pay for things. When we expanded Medicaid in the state of Minnesota, we really grew the pool of people, obviously, that are covered under Medicaid services. And Medicaid now covers about 1 in 5 Minnesotans, so 1 million people in the state of Minnesota are covered by Medicaid. So this changes the scope of how this bill affects people. But I just want to touch on that because I think it is very important to really get at the essence of this bill, which is about how we're paying for things, and that does really represent our budget and our values. And our choices that we make as a legislature.
And one of the things that that I think it's important to note is that if you're a vulnerable young mother in the state of Minnesota, you might get treated differently depending on where you come from and what you look like. So I would I think that if you're 18 years old and you have an unplanned pregnancy and you're from Delwood, Minnesota, you probably go to your clinic and see your family doctor, and they will probably talk about a range of things. They will probably talk about your baby. They probably won't think about that when they discuss that with you, but those are the kinds of words that will be used with that woman in that instance, in that situation, if you're from the zip code 55110. And you go to the doctor. If you're an 18-year-old and you live in Frogtown, it might be a different circumstance. You might go to the clinic that performs what is referred to this committee as complete health care services, which is restricted actually to women and reproductive health care services, and you might be questioned about, how do you intend to pay for this child? How are you going to cover the cost of this child? How are you going to raise this child? Those kinds of value decisions are, what are you going to do with this pregnancy? Those are the kinds of value decisions that we put on people. And Representative Liebling brought up the point. She said, I believe this woman who should not be carrying a child. Who are we to say who should and should not be carrying a child? Those are value determinations that people with money and influence make about other people. So I would ask the same question that a lot of the opponents of this bill ask: who are we? Who are we? So I just want to really challenge people to. It's very easy to get defensive and to kind of run back to the corner of your opinion on this issue. And it's easy to become very defensive about your position on this this issue. And so I think it's very important for us to look at the bill exactly as it is. And in future, if we are very concerned about following the law, that we actually look at abortion provider services and to see which of those dollars actually are going, Medicaid dollars that are public dollars are actually being spent. So. I thank the authors of the bill for bringing this forward, Representative Pugh and Representative Franson. Thank you for doing that. I look forward to the debate ahead as this moves forward in committee process. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to respond briefly to that comment. So I had just, when I was talking about young kids or young women, I had just taken a look at the report on abortions that is put out by the Minnesota Department of Health, and I saw that there were, in 2015, there were 16 women, Minnesota residents, 18 altogether in Minnesota, women who had abortions who were less than 15 years old. So when I said that there are some I don't think should be having babies, I mean, I think possibly we could agree that children should not be having babies. I mean, I don't think that any of us think it's a great thing if somebody younger than 15 years old is pregnant. My goodness. But I think the thing is, Representative Dean, I'm not imposing my will on that woman as a policymaker. I don't think even with that woman, that child, that girl, once she's pregnant, I don't think that that government should be telling her whether or not she should have the baby. That's really the difference. You know, I think, sure, I have a judgment, a personal value judgment, I suppose. I hope a lot of people share it, that young girls should not be having babies. But I'm not imposing my will and saying this young girl should have or must have an abortion. Far from it. And I think that's really the issue here today is whether we allow women to make their own choices given their own life circumstances with their own families, whether it's a husband, whether it's a boyfriend, whether it's, you know, with their mother helping them, whether it's with their own religious advisor, or whether we as government try to make it harder for them to make that choice. I think that's the issue before us today. And Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I this does become a political issue. I think a lot of Minnesotans want to know where we stand on this, and so I would request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a response to Representative Dean, who I think made some assumptions around values. And I'm responding because you made Falltown, right? And I represent Falltown. And the statement was that if you live in Dalewood, you would most likely go to a family physician, and they would talk about options and counseling and things like that. And if you live in Falltown, the questions would be more around how would you raise this kid, how would you pay it for it. And I would say that is definitely an assumption about how the conversation may go. Because, and I don't have the statistics on, you know, rural versus urban and who's having the most abortions or not, or, you know, or family members. I don't have those stats in front of me. But, I remember a young girl from my district who was 16 and was pregnant, played basketball for the high school, was doing well in school, and, was doing great. Had a twin sister and, really didn't plan to be a young mother or want to be a young mother, and she had to make decisions, and there were encounters on both sides, doing counseling with her and helping her to make a decision about how she wanted to move forward. There was some education that was done, the type of supports that would be there on, or whatever decision that she decided to make. And this young lady in Falltown, 16-year-old from Central High School, who played basketball, decided to have her baby. She's a beautiful young girl that's 5 years old now in kindergarten. But that was a decision that she made, because she had a network of support. She had people who were advising her, counseling her, talking to her, gave her options to help her make a decision about how to move forward. And so I just share that because I don't want us to make assumptions in this body about our community. And I agree with you. Unfortunately, you're right. Poor people of color are disproportionately, we're not all valued and invested in this and seen in the same way. I do agree with that. And that is the history of. And it's something that, we have to work towards making things better at. But I just needed to share that with you because we are a community with values. We are a community of people who support each other. And we really are a community of people who have solutions. So I just share it with you because, maybe we could run some data and see if possible. We have large families. We have large families because we don't have abortions. So I don't want you to make assumptions here. And people make those decisions for many, many different reasons. They do. So, I just need to respond to my Falltown for people that know that,
Mr. Chair.
Your name.
And thank you. Thank you for not just responding to that, but thank you for correcting me. So I appreciate that. I like to be corrected. I was not making the point perhaps as well as I should, and I apologize for that. But I know you represent Frogtown, and I know that you do that very well, and I represent my hometown, and I try to do that as best I can. I think that what I would like to share with you and to work with you on, Representative, is the disparities in how we're treating people, how we're having health outcomes, but also how we value people. And I don't think it should be dependent on zip code. I think that isn't a very, very good discussion that we need to have moving forward. And it's one that I care a lot about. I think that you do too. And particularly was responding to clinics that predominantly are known to perform abortion as being purported to this and other committees as being comprehensive care for people. So that was the context of my statement, and thank you for correcting me.
Final word, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in 1997, I was just newly married. I was in college. I was starting my third year in college, and on contraception, birth control. And wasn't feeling very well, very sick. And there was a party on a Friday night that I wanted to go to. I was underage, but, you know, it's college. I wanted to go to a party. And I talked to my friend, and I said, I think I might be pregnant. And she said, well, let's run to the store and find out. So we went to Target in Duluth. And we couldn't wait. So in the bathroom, I took that pregnancy test, and immediately I found out I was pregnant in the bathroom of Target. I'm 20 years old. I didn't even really have a job. I'm in college. I had left my home before I turned 18, or as soon as I turned 18, before I graduated college, or graduated high school, I had left my home. I had couch hopped for a little bit until another family took me in. I went to college as a, I went to college not on my parents' financial, I was considered an independent student. And I had my great uncle had to write letters for me each year so that I could continue going to college, saying that I was independent. So when I got married, that kind of changed, because then I was no longer considered independent, because now I was married to somebody else that was going to college, and we were both now, that situation had changed. So I'm 20 years old. I don't have a really good relationship with my parents. I don't have a job. I'm in college. I want to finish college, because my whole life I was told I was never going to accomplish anything in my life. So what am I going to do? My husband was out on guards training, and when he got back, or when he called me for a ride, I can't really remember, but I told him, I said, I have some news to tell you. And he goes, you're pregnant. I said, what are we going to do? He goes, well, what are we going to do? Can't really do anything about it. You're pregnant. I'll be home on Friday, and I picked him up, and that was that. On Monday, I went, made that appointment at UMD there, and went to get it verified that I was pregnant, and sure enough. And today she'll be 19 in May. Her middle name is August, because she was conceived in August. But it wasn't tough. It wasn't easy. It was very tough. I finished college, but it was tough. But what pulled me through that was the hope that I had for that I was given from my grandparents, from friends, from the support that I had going to college and being with other women that have were pregnant and had also been pregnant in college. And, of course, the willpower to prove people wrong that had that fought that against me my whole entire life. So this bill is simply because I had sex, and sex makes a baby. And I knew that there was a chance of becoming pregnant. And when that happened, I took responsibility. And if you want government out of the way of abortions, then perhaps government should stop funding abortions. And with that, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Franz, we renew her motion on House File 8090 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. A roll call then requested. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Kroonhagen?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Albright?
Aye.
Representative Allen?
No.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yep.
Representative Flanagan?
No.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Cagle?
No.
Representative Kreshaw?
Aye.
Representative Wilmer?
Yes.
Representative McDonald?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
Representative Sandstead?
Yes.
Representative Tice?
Yes.
There being 14 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 809 is referred to Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. With that, members, we have only 4 minutes left in committee, so we will recess until 15 minutes after session this evening. We will get an email out with the room, and I will also announce it at the end of session, which everyone else seems to really enjoy. With that, we are in recess.
the goal?
That's the one.
Right.
The one that Mel Gibson just put out. Yeah, Exodus. That was about as close to Saving Private Ryan.
I'll let you do it.
Oh my gosh. Go ahead, you've seen it?
No.
You need to see it. The cinematography is exceptional.
Well, Mel Gibson got the one award.
This one, the money is in the
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Do you want to talk over the phone, or what do you want to do?
I could
step out. Okay.
Good learning. And she's very good. Baby also was not. She's just very, you can assign them. Omar.
Is that what you call a sambuski or so? Sambuska?
I'm not hurting them. I don't know if everyone even knew.
Yeah, the announcement.
Is that what you call it? Is that a sambuska? Is that a sambuska or sambuski or what? I get it.
Oh, yeah.
All right, the Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come back to order.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, before we take up the bill, I went back just to confirm my recollection and actually watched the video of our meeting from earlier today.
How did I look, Representative Freiberg?
You looked fabulous as always. However, at the end of the meeting, you said that we would reconvene 15 minutes after session this evening. I'm worried that members of the public who are interested in this bill, which is of a topic that a lot of people are very interested in, did not have sufficient notice of any sort and were actually kind of received faulty information under the belief that session would be longer this evening. So I have some real concerns if we go forward with this bill that members of the public who are interested in being here, who are interested in testifying, who are interested in watching, have not had the opportunity to do so, will not have the opportunity to do so. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
As we know, the legislative session, things are fluid, and I wasn't anticipating this process ahead of time myself, and but here we are within the process, and so we'll continue forward now that we're reconvened. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I also have a concern about the notice aspect. I don't recall hearing a notice on the floor even that we were going to be reconvening. Another member pointed out that they saw it in their email that we were reconvening. And I'd like to ask, did the Republican members know, or I should say, when did the Republican members know that we were going to be reconvening and taking this 90-minute break and then reconvening for committee? Can the chair answer that question?
Thank you, Representative Liebling. The Republican members got the same notice that everyone else did for the reconvene for this evening. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did check with the person who, Ms. Ledger, who wants to testify on this. And she was, before we adjourned, on her way to pick up her daughter from school. So she said she was doing that and she would be back as soon as she could. And I hope that we were able to, keep the committee in process so she's able to make it back and testify.
Okay, thank you for that. Representative
Wheatley. Mr. Chair, even though the Republican members didn't learn of it before the Democratic members, and I appreciate that at least, I really want to strongly object to this process because this process is not only about the members who are sitting around this table who represent their constituents. It's also about the public having an opportunity to weigh in. And we all understand that emergencies happen, but this was not an emergency. This bill is certainly not an emergency. I think people understand that this bill is probably not going to go a long way. But besides that, it's just really a violation of members' expectations. You and I walked over to the floor together, and we're chatting about the fact that, I said to you it might be a long evening, and you didn't. I don't know if you knew at that time or not that this was going to happen. Maybe you didn't, but I think that taking a recess in the middle of hearing some pretty important bills and then notifying people by email that we're suddenly reconvening hours probably ahead of when they expected that to happen is really not fair to the public. And so I really just want to register my objection on the record to that process. I think it's very unfair. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's all I'll say about it.
All right. Thank you for your comments. And we are sure to have that on the record for this evening. With that, Representative Keel will move that House File 812 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Keel, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 812 is a bill that requires a licensure of certain facilities that perform abortions requiring a license fee. So our intent is to add protection for the safety of women. That's what this is about. There are facilities for a one-day procedure for women that should be handled as an outpatient surgical center. And with that, I have Ms. Rao with me to testify.
Ms. Rao, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am again representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, which is Minnesota's oldest and largest pro-life organization. I would like to again thank the committee for allowing me to speak today. And personally, I'd like to thank you for doing so during more normal hours instead of after my bedtime. I would like to urge the committee to pass House File 812, which requires that Minnesota abortion facilities be licensed and inspected by the state. More than 40 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down the Roe v. Wade decision, which, along with its companion case, legalized abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason. Supporters of the decision were pleased that women would no longer have to engage in unsanitary,
illegal and unsafe abortions. So I ask the committee today, how is it that not very long ago, a grand jury report regarding a Pennsylvania abortion facility, the doctor who ran it, and several of his staff was able to stun our nation, pro-life and pro-choice alike, by shedding light on the unsanitary, illegal, and unsafe abortions that were happening at a clinic there. Dr. Gosnell, who ran the facility, and others were found guilty of a variety of charges and were sent to prison. I will spare the committee details on how Gosnell killed viable babies accidentally born alive, but I will share with you that the district attorney in Philadelphia referred to the clinic as, quote, decrepit and unsanitary, staffed entirely with unlicensed personnel. According to the United States Supreme Court, quote, Gosnell's deplorable crimes could escape detection only because his facility went uninspected for more than 15 years. Pennsylvania had a law requiring inspection of abortion facilities, but for political reasons, the inspections didn't happen. I'd like to remind the committee that Minnesota doesn't even have an inspection requirement for abortion facilities. Within the last few weeks, a pair of news reports centered on different industries highlighted a lack of state inspections as leading to significant problems. First, a Carrie Levin story focused on uninspected nail salons and a woman who lost four fingernails. When an inspection was finally done in the nail salon, 28 violations were found, including half the staff being unlicensed. A few days later, Rachel Sassenberger of the Pioneer Press published a story on the lack of investigations into complaints at nursing homes. I'm guessing that several of you are well aware of the issue, as it has been focused on in committee hearings as well. According to MDH budget requests, quote, thousands of complaints are not investigated, and so maltreatment continues, and less severe issues may escalate to more serious harm. When looking at abortion facilities, it is important to note that most patients won't even bother to file a complaint, even if they have significant concerns with something that has happened at an abortion facility. We know this anecdotally. Think of how long Dr. Gosnell's clinic operated before being shut down. And intuitively. Unlike patients who go to a clinic and have an ongoing relationship with the facility and medical staff, but very much like others who receive care at an outpatient surgical center, abortion facility patients typically have a one-day relationship with that facility. They go for their procedure, and they don't plan to go back. This in itself is a reason that many abortion patients are less likely to report a problem with the facility. But when you add to the fact that women who have abortions typically tell few people and don't want others to know, you end up with a scenario where women are very unlikely to report problems. This is a key reason why we need inspections, along with basic licensing requirements. Some have suggested that this legislation may be unconstitutional based on a recent United States Supreme Court case. However, I would like to point out a few key differences. The Supreme Court took great effort to evaluate a number of facts as they related to the law in Texas, which was challenged, and their ruling was very much based upon those facts. Additionally, the court has recognized that, quote, the constitutionality of a statute predicated upon the existence of a particular state of facts may be challenged by showing to the court that those facts have ceased to exist. The plain fact is that the facts in Texas vary greatly from the facts in Minnesota. In regard to whether or not a woman's health was protected by the new law, the court stated, quote, women will not obtain better care or experience more frequent positive outcomes at an ambulatory surgical center as compared to a previously licensed facility. I'd like to emphasize that previously licensed facility. You see, Texas already required licensure of abortion facilities as well as inspections. The court ruled that the health of women wasn't further protected by the new regulations because such regulations already existed. This is not the case in Minnesota. Second, the court ruled that an undue burden existed in Texas after passage of the law because of two key issues. First, included in the new Texas law was a requirement that abortion facilities obtain admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Many abortion facilities were refused admitting privileges and thus would be forced to shut down. Two, although Texas had previously waived parts of the regulation for nearly two-thirds of licensed facilities, they refused to allow such exemptions for abortion facilities. This also led to a number of facilities being forced to shut down under the new law. But these facts would not be a part of the Minnesota story. Our legislation does not include an admitting privileges provision, and our regulatory structure allows for some regulations to be waived at the discretion of the Minnesota Department of Health. When looking at these significant differences, it is very reasonable to believe that the court would uphold the legislation before you today. The truth is that the women of Minnesota deserve the assurance that they will never walk into a facility that has the unsanitary, illegal, and unsafe conditions that were found at the facility in Pennsylvania. But that assurance isn't guaranteed under our current laws. However, it can be provided through common sense licensing and inspection standards for abortion facilities that provide 10 or more abortions per month. These are the abortion facilities that act like an outpatient surgical center. The legislation before you today would merely require such facilities to be inspected by the state and subject to the same outpatient surgical center licensure requirements. On behalf of MCCL's grassroots supporters, I urge the committee to support House File 812. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Rao. Questions for Ms. Rao, Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question. When did you hear about the new committee time? It just seems odd that the people testifying in favor of the bill knew to be here on time, but the people who might have spoken in opposition had to rush over here in a hurry. So I'm just curious when you heard about the new committee time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg. I rushed as well.
Representative Freiberg. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This discussion continues, and I'm glad to be talking on behalf of someone who couldn't be here to testify, but we have a clinic in Duluth that provides women's reproductive health. And last year they served more women at this clinic in other services related to cervical cancer screenings, breast cancer screenings, just overall reproductive health, more than they did around pregnancy termination. And so in chatting with them, and I've actually, I care a lot about this issue, and I actually asked to go visit their center and have visited their center and have been through, and it is not at all what I heard described or what the fear is, and I invite anybody that has concerns to come visit the center in Duluth because it provides a lot of services that a lot of low-income women, a lot of people throughout the region, it serves 20 counties that women come to visit. And that has nothing to do with pregnancy termination. It has to do with overall reproductive health around breast cancer, cervical screenings, other things, enrolling in health care plans, a whole variety of services. So in chatting with them, they shared that these types of things, they already passed certifications, were inspected back in September, they carry all these insurances, they do a lot to uphold a really great center that provides a lot. So I guess my question would be, what happens to these women throughout our region that come to the center for these other services because from what I understand talking with them, the center would have to shut down because of the cost it would take. Their space is restricted, what they would need to do. So could you just share a little bit about what would happen with these other women that come here for those services?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, members of the committee, I would suggest that if they are unable to be granted a waiver by the Department of Health because they're not able to meet those basic standards, that they stop providing abortions and continue providing all of that other care to women.
Representative Olson.
So to that point, so it would create an undue process and burden on the center to have to be able to provide basic services.
Ms. Rao.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Olson, I'm not sure how that provides a burden on the center to provide those other services. I would think that they could continue providing those services if they wished and if they were so important.
Could you speak to the waiver process? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you speak to the waiver process and the timeliness and how quickly that would move if a center like this in Duluth and the costs that they might have to incur if they had to shut down for a period of time or whatnot to go through this waiver process?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, members of the committee, I am not from the department, so I can't speak to exactly the process that they go through. I can tell you that there is the waiver exists in Minnesota Rules, Chapter 4675, and you know, a little bit of information can be found there. Otherwise, I guess that would be a question for the department.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then further, so that's just one piece of it, right? I think there's also the piece that the service it does provide, a safe, legal place for women throughout the region to access services related to their choice around reproductive health and that, and pregnancy termination being that. And to think about this regional center essentially closing and providing, you know, the geography, I mean, it seems very intentional that the spirit of this is to close this center and to create an undue process, an undue burden on women from greater Minnesota and leave them in a lurch. And it seems like that's the spirit of it, because it's not, you know, it just, we've talked about, and you say it's different here in Minnesota, but I just worry that people from my region, in particular, and we talk about rural Minnesota, we talk about making sure that we're taking care of all folks throughout greater Minnesota. This place is a real undue burden, specifically for women in greater Minnesota to get the reproductive health care that they need.
Ms. Rao, any follow-up?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, I would just like to stress that the intent of this legislation is to protect women's health and safety.
Representative Olson.
And I guess I would go back to my first point, Mr. Chair, about I visited this center. It's above board. It has great doctors that know what they're doing. I would say then we should do the same when we're thinking about vasectomies and other outpatient services. If this is what we're going to do around women's health, then we should really do the same around making sure that all places that provide vasectomies as outpatient services have the same standard.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Ms. Is it Rao?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Rao, thank you. You cited the Hall Women's Health versus Hellerstedt case. Have you read that case?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, yes, I have.
Representative Allen.
So, you know, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's 105 pages, I believe. And so you would know that you said that that it was a very fact-intensive case, but that sort of, that the language that you quoted was in about the first 20, 30 pages, where they dealt with res judicata claims preclusion. So it was something that the plaintiff, which was Women's Health, had to defend against a motion for that it was, that the case was barred by res judicata or the claims preclusion, various arguments. And so that was part of it, was that they weren't, even though they had brought a similar case before, they weren't precluded from bringing the case again, dealing with the same clinics because facts had changed. So that was so the test in the case is whether, and this is what the court wrote, and they're citing Casey, an undue burden exists, and therefore a provision of law is invalid, if its purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. So they're focusing on whether the law places a substantial obstacle, they're talking about access, basically. And so the court reversed the district court because the district court wanted to
give great deference that say that the fact-finding of the legislature was dispositive, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it's a, well, you give deference to the fact-finding of the legislature, it's not dispositive. And so that what you have to do is you have to weigh the benefits and the burden. And so in that case, Texas had to show the benefits, and they were not persuasive. There was a, and it was fact, you know, they had expert witnesses showing the burden, because half of the clinics closed in Texas, and that these clinics that remained open would have had to serve five times as many clients, and they said that was just, you know, that was too, not even possible. I mean, it would be, and that, in fact, it jeopardized the safety of women, because there was fewer available, they were overburdened. And so that, so this whole, trying to show the benefit, there were no experts presented by Texas. There was no, they couldn't even point to one case where, they had to do surgery in the abortion, in the clinic. They couldn't present one case, and this is over years. They could not present one case where they jeopardized the woman's health because the doctor performing did not have admitting privileges. Because, as you were, I think, talking about, that most women, the complications, if they do occur, will occur after, and oftentimes the, and almost every case, they'll go to their local family doctor or their local clinic, or so in that case there wasn't any evidence. I mean, the court was just like at a loss to like find some benefit, and said that it was clear that the clinics had demonstrated that there was an underburden, and that it wasn't even like close. So if you're going to, you know, develop a, if you said it would be, that we have to wait, and so we have to, so we enact, so if we were to enact this law, and then we wait, and then you see whether or not half the clinics closed, and whether a woman had to travel more than 150 miles, or, but in the meantime, you know whether there are any cases. And that case that you cited about the, is it Dr. Grassnell, I'm not pronouncing that, where there was the unlicensed, and there's pages in this 105-page opinion of Whole Woman's Health talking about that case, and said that the laws that were at issue in that case, none of them would have prevented what happened in this case. It was not inspected. And so it was criminal activity, and that a law that Texas was trying to pass would not have prevented it. That's what they concluded. And so there's a really good discussion of that criminal activity, and how that's not, you know, that's outside of something that would not have been prevented. And so I would encourage you to read those sections. I'll stop there. But,
thank all you. Right. Response, Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, and members of the committee, I did read those sections as well. And the court, as I had quoted it previously in my testimony, said that inspections were needed. And the inspections were already in law but hadn't been followed. And so inspections is what would have stopped him, and the court recognized that. Minnesota does not have a structure for those kinds of inspections to happen. So that is one spot. Another thing I would like to point out is a fair amount of the portion that you were discussing was talking specifically about the admitting privileges, and that is not included in the legislation before you today.
Follow-up, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, but there were pages talking about the surgical centers and the cost of that and the burden of that, and, you know, $1 to $3 million per facility, and that basically, you know, that was part of the main reason why there was half of the facilities closed, and many of them just shut the doors the day the law was in effect. And so the law that you have here would not have prevented what happened in this Gosnell case. Gosnell case, thank you. Would not have prevented that. That was a finding of the, because that was presented. That was presented that was the harm that they were trying to prevent. And the court just said it's not, the laws, the same law you have here about the surgical center licensing requirements would not have prevented that case. That is criminal activity. And that, but in the licensing, it's not, it's one thing to have a licensing inspections, which is completely different than having to spend $3 million to build a surgical center. They're saying the surgical center requirement did nothing to increase the safety of women, that it was completely unnecessary, and that having that requirement that be licensed as a surgical center would not have prevented the criminal conduct.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I could say again that this bill is about more than just the surgical center requirements. It also has an inspection piece. So that would make a difference in the Gosnell case. And I disagree to some extent that this does not protect at all the health and safety of women in the state of Minnesota, including the surgical center requirements. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Rao? All right. Ms. Rao, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Mr. Pollack, please make your way forward, and if you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health, and appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. So I just want to say at the outset that we recognize the bill has bipartisan support, and we appreciate that legislators on both sides of the debate are focused on best protecting the health and safety of patients. I'll add that I think we have a lot of really good opportunities this session to work on improving health for women who are pregnant, and particularly with family home visiting, like has already been heard. We think we can do a lot to keep the abortion rate at an all-time low, which it is now in Minnesota and I believe in the country. MDH works to achieve health equity in Minnesota, where all communities are thriving and all people have what they need to be healthy. We ensure that safe conditions exist in 4,800 healthcare facilities and also provide a timely response to more than 24,000 maltreatment allegations annually in the vulnerable adult area. House File 812 would apply our existing state rules for regulation and licensure of ambulatory surgery centers to 5 outpatient clinics, which perform 10 or more abortions per month. Minnesota's 1,250 other similar clinics that perform non-abortion services would not be similarly regulated. Current law, Minnesota Statutes 145.416, already directs the Commissioner of Health to license and regulate facilities providing abortion services. However, the Department of Health is unable to operationalize that section of law due to a permanent injunction of our agency's rulemaking, which was issued by a federal district court in 1977 as part of the Hodgson v. Lawson series of Eighth Circuit and Minnesota District Court decisions. More recently, this case law and this issue has been relitigated by the U.S. Supreme Court, as has already been mentioned in Hellerstad. And I think Representative Allen kind of went into a lot of the reasons for that, so I won't take up your time listing all of them, but the court did find that abortion facilities, at least in Texas, you know, already meet a host of health and safety requirements and are enforced through administrative, civil, and criminal penalties, that there are additional requirements that are generally viewed as unnecessary in the abortion clinic context, and that the legislation, that the law in Texas was unconstitutional, and we view this legislation as being substantially similar. In terms of clinic level licensure, we really believe it's unnecessary to take this step, regardless of what kind of procedure they're performing, because clinics are already subjected to significant oversight. Nurses and physicians are licensed under health licensing boards to enforce standards of practice. They're held accountable there. Federal Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, or CLIA, standards set requirements for clinical laboratories. OSHA workplace requirements must be met. There are local building codes that enforce life safety and fire safety. Health insurers inspect clinical providers as part of their in-network contracting. And Minnesota providers comply with clinical policy guidelines and quality standards established by national credentialing organizations that work to enhance safety and quality of services. And this would include issues like infection prevention, use of antibiotics or sedation, and treatment of complications. If the legislature, the committee, feels that patient safety concerns for clinics are of concern, I would suggest and propose that we improve safety and standards for all clinics, not a selected few. The commissioner asked me to remind the committee that the bill or a nearly identical version was vetoed by Governor Dayton in 2012 based on the concerns that I've described. We do have technical staff here. Happy to take questions about the bill. I think we have a fiscal note, but that's probably not in this committee. So.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pollack, for your testimony this evening. Questions for Mr. Pollack? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pollack, I wonder if you have the information to tell the committee some of the items that are in that regulation that the bill seeks to, in the rule that the bill seeks to apply to clinics. The bill, of course, just refers to licensure requirements provided in Minnesota Rules Chapter 4675 and doesn't really discuss what those are, and I took a look at the rule, and there are quite a few things in there. So I wonder if you could just give us some highlights of what that would involve.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Rule Chapter 4675 is extensive. I won't take up the committee's time with an exhaustive list, but they are physical plant requirements and other requirements designed for surgical procedures. So that would include a separate patient prep area, surgery area, post-recovery area. Within the surgical suite, they required an operating room, a separate clean workroom for collecting materials used during surgery, a soiled workroom for materials from the surgery, a separate space for cleaning equipment, a janitor's closet within the suite, separate male-female gowning areas for staff that include lockers and a toilet. You can read the rule. It is fairly extensive.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Pollack, I take it from your testimony that the Department of Health has an opinion that these facilities, that the current facilities are, that there's no safety issue right now for women having abortions in our facilities in Minnesota. Is that accurate?
Mr. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, that would be my testimony. We have not received any complaints about them, and that would be inappropriate for us to receive any complaints. Those complaints would go to the boards, respective boards of medical practice or nursing.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Pollack, you're not aware that there have been complaints. I guess you're saying you wouldn't necessarily know about them, but you're not aware that there are complaints coming to those boards about these centers that we have in Minnesota?
Mr. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that's correct. I don't know of any complaints against them, and we do receive a lot of complaints, as I mentioned, 24,000.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Liebling. Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Pollack? Seeing none, the committee thanks you, Mr. Pollack, for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 812? All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me be here today to testify. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. I'm here to testify that this bill is unconstitutional, and you've already heard a little bit about the Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt decision, and you heard from Ms. Rao that that bill took up both admitting privileges and ambulatory surgical center requirements. What I want to talk about is the test that the court established in that case, which was a form of heightened scrutiny. The court said in that case that only laws that further a valid state interest, confer benefits that outweigh burdens, and are based on credible evidence meet the standard. Even without the admitting privileges requirement in the bill today, this bill still does not meet that standard that the court established in Whole Woman's Health. In that decision, the court found that, quote, the surgical center requirement, like the admitting privileges requirement, provides few, if any, health benefits to women, poses a substantial obstacle to women seeking abortions, and constitutes an undue burden on their constitutional right to do so. So just as with Texas HB 2, the stated goals of the bill before you are not medically justified and will not provide any health benefits to women. Abortion is an extremely safe procedure. The state of Minnesota annually publishes a report on induced abortions in Minnesota. For 2015, which is the year that we most recently have data available, the complication rate for abortion was 0.01%. That makes abortion safer than appendectomies, and research confirms that the risk of death from abortion is lower than that from a shot of penicillin. What this bill does do is close clinics. If enacted, 4 of the 5 abortion clinics in Minnesota will be forced to close due to the expense of meeting surgical center requirements. You have written testimony, and you heard from Representative Olson about the Women's Health Center of Duluth, which would have to spend upwards of $800,000 to meet these building requirements. Unnecessary and burdensome regulations can make abortion less safe for patients. In a 2011 analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine, a healthcare economist stated that restrictions aimed at shutting down providers, or he called them supply-side policies, had little effect on demand for abortion. Instead, they either forced women to travel further to obtain health care or denied those with the fewest resources the ability to access wanted services. The study predicted that, quote, making access to abortion unnecessarily costly through such restrictions will probably result in clandestine abortions and unintended childbearing among families with the least resources and the fewest options. And that's exactly what happened in Texas after the passage of the unconstitutional HB 2. A study from the University of Texas found that between 100,000 and 240,000 women of reproductive age attempted self-inducing abortion following the closure of clinics in Texas. 8 of the 10 states with the highest search rates for self-induced abortions are considered hostile or very hostile to abortion rights. By the Guttmacher Institute, self-induction, as you might assume, can result in injury, infertility, or even death. The final point I would make is that this bill would cost Minnesota taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars or even millions in legal fees. In at least 8 states around the country, courts have used the Whole Woman's Health decision to block abortion restrictions, and state advocates and health departments have used the decision to repeal regulations that conflict with the legal standard established by Whole Woman's Health. States have spent millions of dollars defending against unconstitutional restrictions on abortions, both in their own legal fees and in judgments to pay the challenger's legal fees. In just 2016, Wisconsin agreed to pay $1.6 million to Planned Parenthood and other challenges of an unconstitutional admitting privileges bill. This bill is unconstitutional, does not protect women's health, and could cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend. For all of these reasons, Governor Dayton vetoed a similar bill in 2012, and I urge you to oppose it today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Ledger, for your testimony this evening. Questions for Ms. Ledger, Representative McDonald?
Just a question. What was the statistic you gave in less than a percentage of injuries or... What was that? Could you repeat that, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, less than 0.01% complication rate, according to the most recent Minnesota Department of Health report, and that's the 2015 report.
Representative McDonald.
No questions at this point.
Mm-hmm. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so would you say it's fair to say that there was some sort of suggestion that this case, this bill might be perceived differently by or interpreted differently by the courts, or that the outcome in a Supreme Court case, if we dealt with this, might be different because Minnesota is different. But really, the reason it's a losing case and why all these similar laws are getting overturned is because it is what Ms. Rav said about the facts changing, that that was about the burden and that it took some time to develop the facts about having how access was burdened and how many closures, how far you had to travel, how many women were being served. It took some time to develop those. And so that was the facts. But that the state's burden of proof showing benefit, that there is no, that that's why the state's going to lose, and is because there is no, that's not something that any state so far has been able to prove with this, with respect to this type of licensing. Is that fair to say?
Ms. Ledger. Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, again, the test that the court laid out was that there must be a valid state interest, it must confer benefits that outweigh burdens to the women seeking abortion, and it has to be based on credible evidence. And so I think with that standard applied here, that this does not meet the standard. I would further say that in the Wisconsin case that I cited earlier, the admitting privileges case, that case didn't include a surgical center requirement. It was only about one of the aspects of the Texas law. And so I think we've seen federal courts are willing to apply the standard to different types of restrictions.
Representative Allen.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Ledger? Seeing none, Ms. Ledger, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. All right, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 812? Seeing none, we'll move to amendments. We have the A1 amendment. Representative Liebling, would you like to move your amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment. And members, the A1 amendment is actually came from, this is an amendment that was put on the bill in the Senate. And it seemed appropriate, if the bill is going to move, that we do something similar here. And I know that a lot of us are concerned about privacy. And so that's what this amendment is. It's where a lot of us in the House here, especially more than the Senate, I would say, or at least more than the Senate traditionally has been, we're concerned about privacy of people's information. So what this amendment says is that if, assuming this bill would become law, and there would be these inspections, that the people doing the inspections would not have access to any health records, so that the health records of the patients in that clinic would remain private from those inspectors. Also, I think, as we heard from Ms. Olson here, there are other things going on. Even if you thought, oh, it's fine to, you know, expose the health records of women seeking abortion, which I would hope you would not, but there are women seeking all kinds of health services in these places, and their information should not be exposed. And it also says, or records that identify a provider who furnishes health care services in the facility. So this is important to protect both women who are seeking health services, whether abortion or not, and others who are providing services, because we know that there's sometimes providers of abortion services, but also just people who happen to work in these clinics are sometimes exposed to violence when their names become known publicly. So this is important just to protect Minnesotans who are delivering health services to women in centers that are also providing abortion. So I would like a roll call on this, Mr. Chair.
A roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
And I hope this is something that everybody here, I think, cares about privacy and privacy of records. I hope this is something everyone can support.
All right, discussion to the A1 amendment, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Levy. You know, we've been very careful in crafting this legislation to maintain the same standards for abortion facilities and outpatient surgical centers. I'm not comfortable with changing to a new standard only for abortion facilities, especially when we have worked so hard to make it clear that we want to treat abortion facilities just like outpatient surgical centers. I have full trust that the investigators at Minnesota Department of Health will protect the privacy of those at the abortion facility, just as they do at other outpatient surgical centers.
If you are truly concerned that this isn't the case, I suggest you introduce legislation and apply this standard to all outpatient surgical centers. And I would ask the committee to oppose this amendment.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Representative Wavelin.
Well, thank you. Well, Representative Keel, I wonder if you could tell us, you know, when the last time there was a demonstration and when people were threatened who were working in regular surgical, outpatient surgical centers. Are you aware of that happening?
Representative Keel.
No, I'm not.
Representative Wavelin.
Well, thank you. So, Representative Keel, this bill itself singles out abortion providers for special treatment that they don't need. And if you're going to say that they should be inspected when they don't need inspection, it is pretty clear, I think, that demonstrators gather outside of these facilities. I think it's pretty clear that across the country, abortion providers have even been murdered in cold blood because of services that they're providing to women that are legal. And so I do think they need special protection. I absolutely do, both the providers and the patients. You know, women who are going to get an abortion, not only do they have to make a very difficult decision and in some cases I'm sure that decision is excruciating for them, depending on their personal circumstances, then they have to run the gauntlet of protesters often standing outside these clinics yelling horrible things at them and calling them names. I'm not saying anyone here condones that. I'm just saying that they are deserving of special protection to make sure that if there are inspections in these facilities, that those inspections are not somebody rifling through their own medical records when that otherwise wouldn't be permitted. So I hope members can vote for this.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Keel, laws, of course, matter. They're words, but they have the force of law. And I think the amendment that Representative Liebling is offering up is certainly common sense, but also would set as the law clarity around the expectation of inspection. And while I think, you know, in a normal circumstance, we could have faith in inspectors. I think given the circumstances of this legislation and, just what it is that we're asking to be done, I think it would be important, I think it would be really important for us to be clear about what's inspected and what's not inspected. So I am not confident in your faith and, that the records of the people in these clinics would be secure or safe unless we put it into law. And I just want to know from you, my question for you is, for something as important as the confidentiality of these records in this space, knowing the turmoil that the people getting care in these facilities often experience, don't you think their confidentiality, don't you think the privacy of their records is important enough that it should have the force of law and that we should include it in this legislation where you are claiming the importance of protecting the lives and the health of women? Don't you think their privacy is as important as their safety and security inside that clinic?
Representative Keel.
I wonder how you would know if there was a real challenge, whether or not, when they're inspecting, if they weren't able to check records. I believe that's done on many other inspections that are not so severe, so concerning, challenging a life, because that's what's happening here. And I think we would want to know. I'm surprised that we would not want to know if the centers that provide women's health, not just abortions, but all of the things that you were talking about, contraceptives and and desk exams and cervical checks and all of the other conversations that could happen. We would want a facility to know exactly are they treating those patients right and are they doing things in a manner. Do we even know if, and actually there are stories out there that we know now, that not everybody that's providing an abortion is actually a nurse or a doctor. I think we need to confirm that within our system here in Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Representative Keel, are you suggesting then that the record should be open for examination?
Representative Keel.
I would want them to be really careful about it, certainly. It's a privacy issue. But I have a hard time with how do you inspect or license a facility if you need to ask a question of about a specific time that someone would need, when the background would need to be checked. I don't think that you have to inspect everything and know every patient and every incident. But I would think, I would really hope that the Department of Health knows when to do that and what. I mean, that's got to be their job. Everybody that works on health issues knows that there's a privacy issue.
Representative Murphy.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Keel, if we don't pass this amendment, then you're suggesting that an inspector could have open access to the records of women getting their care.
Representative Keel.
I guess that's what I'm suggesting, yeah.
Well, then, Mr. Chair and members, I sure hope that we support Representative Liebling's amendment.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if Mr. Pollack would come back to the testifying table for a question, please.
I think he was hoping for that. Mr. Pollack, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't go that far.
Mr. Pollack, thank you.
Representative Baker.
So my recollection of your testimony earlier, and my prior involvement with your department as a restaurant owner, I work with the Department of Health all the time. I assume you do a lot of inspections. I think I've heard thousands of inspections. Do you dig through medical records at this point with other areas and other clinics and restaurants to look through kind of financial information or personal information at this time at other places? I'm just kind of curious what the department does at this point.
Mr. Pollack. Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, no, our inspection staff would adhere as closely to the letter of the law as possible in terms of what they're reviewing.
Thank you.
Representative Baker. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Ms. Rao might approach the stand.
Looks like she's able to make her way down. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Rao, my recollection, if it serves me correctly, is that when inspections occur in any type of a medical facility, those medical records and the information contained therein would be pursuant and covered by HIPAA statute. Is that correct?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, members of the committee, I won't pretend to be an absolute expert in HIPAA and all of the different privacy protections that exist out there, but I will say that this legislation would simply apply the outpatient surgical center standards and investigative responsibilities the same way. And so as Representative Keel had said at the outset, if folks are really concerned about privacy, then I would guess that they would also be concerned about the privacy of others at outpatient surgical centers and the investigations that they do. As Mr. Pollack just testified at the Department of Health, they are the ones that would be doing the investigating, and I have no doubt that they would abide by law and protect the privacy of the patients that are there.
Representative Albright.
No further.
All right. Are there any other questions or discussions to the A1 amendment? Representative Dean.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, I think it's just important to note within the context of the question around inspections and access to medical records, that there would be no reason to access medical records or any private data for an inspection, particularly around the context of the facility itself, and it would, in fact, be a violation. And I'm wondering if Representative Liebling knows of similar instances where, in fact, this is happening, and if we need to look at this beyond this broader context, because it would seem surprising to me that if there were legal violations of that type taking place, that we should, in fact, look at proactive measures to deal with that.
Any other discussion? All right. Did you want Representative Liebling directly on that, or?
Well, I think it just kind of goes without saying that this that it's sort of I think the amendment itself is sort of an accusation that there's somehow illegal activity, or that there's inspectors that are going to be snooping around in medical records, and that if that in fact is taking place by inspectors for facilities of any kind, then I think that we have a greater problem. But if there is that information out there, I would sure like to know it.
All right. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible to have Mr. Pollack come back? Sorry.
Welcome back, Mr. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sandstead.
Mr. Pollack, I don't know if you really answered the question earlier as far as when you go out and do investigations. Do you look into records, or are you aware of that ever happening? And I just, I think this is a really legitimate question that we all want to know the answer to.
Mr. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandstead, yes, we do look at medical records. I think the question that Representative Baker is asking was whether we, and I'm maybe putting words in his mouth, but so feel free to correct me, Representative Baker, but I think his question was, do we adhere to the law in terms of which records or which components of people's personal data we're allowed to, you know, to look at? You know, are our inspectors, looking at information that they're not supposed to? And the answer to that would be no. Doing outpatient surgical centers, the staff are going to handle any protected data extremely carefully. They would have, notes that they take would be destroyed after any correction order is written. And so they're going to do, they're going to be extremely professional. But in terms of looking at patient data, the answer is yes, because you do need to review patient data related to the surgical center's operations to know if a violation has occurred.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you.
To that point, Representative Baker.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I was maybe going to go a little deeper because and maybe you answered it. You do look at medical records when you do inspections. That shocks me a bit, but I don't really do what you do. And so tell us, again, if you could, maybe I missed part of this, but be more specific about what you actually see. Do you see who is there? Is it only when there's an investigation, when there's maybe a claim of a problem, or is it do you look for dates and times and how many procedures they're doing to confirm it? Are you looking at things like that? I'm just curious as to how deep do you really go into these kind of things, because maybe, as Representative Dean said, maybe we do have more of things to look into. So I'm curious as to sharing that with me, please.
Mr. Pollack.
Thank you, Representative Baker and Mr. Chair. I think to your question, the rule would guide which kinds of medical records they are able to look at, and then that information is completely protected the entire time. So they would be reviewing information from a patient who maybe made the complaint to see what kind of surgical procedure they had, whether the outpatient surgical center adhered to the requirements of the rule during that surgical procedure, if there were other patients that had a similar surgical procedure that the rule was violated for. So it would not necessarily encompass all patients for all procedures
at all times, but it would be focused on the basis for the complaint and a violation of the rule.
Representative Baker. Mm-hmm. Any further discussion on the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Being we have Mr. Pollack here, so then if this, I would like to ask him, if okay. this were this amendment were passed, then we couldn't really accurately investigate then, if there was a question.
Mr. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, I think there would be an investigation still. We would not have, as the amendment is written, we would not have access to any health records as defined in the Minnesota Health Records Act or identifying information on a provider. So the inspector would have information not contained in the health record, and whatever information that is, that's what the inspection would include.
Thank you.
Representative Keel. So, any further discussion? Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. So this is not about a complaint-driven thing. This is about a regular inspection taking place, you know, of all of these things that are in that rule that was referred to. And as I mentioned before, this is a particularly sensitive area. This is not where people are getting colonoscopies or something. This is where women... well, that's pretty sensitive, too, but not the fact that person had one, you know, or something else like that. This is particularly sensitive health information. It could get even worse. So, but this is a particularly sensitive area because acts of violence have occurred, because people target these. This bill is targeting these centers. But if this bill would be passed and these centers would be required to have all this additional, these rooms and janitor closets and all that stuff and these inspections, then the idea that somebody, I mean, I trust our Department of Health too, but the Department of the Leadership can change and the inspectors can be different people. And I think it's necessary to have in law some protection for the records. We're talking about routine inspections. We're not talking about where somebody's made a complaint. This is inspections performed under this subdivision, not complaint-driven inspections. But also, this is about also protecting the providers who are subject to violence, who are subject to being killed, murdered, by people who say that they are about protecting life. And this is not... fantasy of mine. This has happened many times where abortion providers have been murdered and where receptionists have been there and targeted and other people who are working in these clinics. So that's why, even if we don't protect the names of people who work in other kinds of facilities, these people deserve protection. The patients and the people who are working there deserve protection. And some of them are probably not having anything to do with abortions. They may be there providing all kinds of other services. But certainly the receptionist who works at a clinic does not deserve to have her name and face broadcast anywhere where she can be made a target of violence. So I hope that members can support the amendment.
Further discussion to the amendment, the A1 amendment. Seeing none, a roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Grunhagen?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Allen?
Pass.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Dean?
Nope.
Representative Flanagan?
Yes.
Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Keel?
No.
Representative Cagle?
Yes.
Representative Crenshaw?
No.
Representative Wilmer?
No.
Representative McDonald?
No.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Stansted?
Yes.
Representative Tice?
No.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
All right, there being 9 ayes and 13 nays, the A1 amendment is not adopted. Discussion to the House File 812. Representative Liebling.
So, you know, a lot's been said, and I'm not going to drag it out, but I just want to mention the irony of a bill like this, because this comes to us from the party that says it's for smaller government, the party that says it's against regulation, the party that wants to, you know, government should, you know, be, it was once said, small enough to drown in a bathtub. And yet when it comes to people interfering in people's lives, wanting them to, when they want to choose abortion, when they make decisions that you don't like, you're more than willing to increase government regulation to interfere in that decision. And I think that's really unfortunate. I just hope that we don't hear any more about smaller government, because that's not the direction that this bill is going.
Any other discussion to House File 812? Seeing none, Representative Keel, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate you taking time to have this discussion. I think it is very important that we talk about abortion centers and Planned Parenthood, Women's Whole Health, all of those facilities that provide services for women. We want to make sure that these facilities that provide one-day procedures or clinic recommendations should be treated and handled as a outpatient surgical center where people are expect good care. And the intent for this is to add protection to the safety of women. We want women to expect and they should deserve the assurance that they will be safe and their health will be cared for, as well as their being when they come in and seek services of any kind. And I thank you again. With that, Mr. Chair, please support the bill.
All right. With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 812 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Liebling requests a roll call. There will be a roll call.
I love roll calls.
The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Schumacher?
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Allen?
No.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Dean? Representative Flanagan?
No.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Peel?
Yes.
Representative Cagle?
No.
Representative Kreshaw?
Yes.
Representative Lomer?
Yes.
Representative McDonald?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Stansted?
Yes.
Representative Tice?
Yes.
All right, there being 13 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and House File 812 is re-referred to Committee on Government Operations. With that, members, we are adjourned.